All right. So last week I talked about distortions around the paramis, these 10 perfections. Because on the one hand, the perfections are such a beautiful thing to aspire to really bring our hearts behind, to try to cultivate in our lives. And they also have a shadow side that we can easily, if we're not conscious of it, become distorted around that. It's not so much that the paramis become distorted, but how we are as we practice them. And three areas that come to mind around that. One is the way that we can, this is what my friend Narayan and teaching colleague sometimes talks about when we use the Dharma as a weapon against ourselves. So we almost weaponize the Dharma. Because we look at this list, these 10 perfections of generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. And we can look at our own lives, our own minds, and say, wow, I'm kind of falling down in some of those. It would seem like they're really far away. So actually we become judgmental of ourselves, you know, our practice. We judge ourselves based on this artificial list of perfections that, okay, I need to get to a level 10 and I'm on a level 5 or whatever it might be. And that's part of the, it's easy to fall into, that's human nature. Right, that's how we're trained to do this in our lives. You know, any skill we learn, any going through school or whatever we might do, there's these things, these benchmarks we try to reach. Okay, here's a whole new set of benchmarks. So we can weaponize the Dharma by finding new ways to feel inadequate, to feel judgmental of ourselves and our practice. Right, so that's the distortion around the equity of these paramis. Another way that's related to that is when we have this sense of trying to become a better version of ourselves. So part of that is very needed and healthy and wholesome, right? Okay, I want to try to become more generous. But we start to become a little attached to that. We start to become, I want to become this generous person. I'm trying to skip over my unconscious quality or my neuroses or my conditioning or how I was raised, all those things, I try to jump over it, do a little spiritual bypassing to get to that ideal phase. So this is also a distortion that comes up. And the final one that comes to mind, this isn't a complete list by any means, but another one related to this is when we start to become attached to the self-image of being a generous person, of being an ethical person, of being a patient person. And that self-image becomes more important than being honest with our humanness. So we're sitting and we're at a holiday gathering and we're trying to be a patient person, but we're anything but patient in this moment as we're talking to that relative who just drones on and on and on about whatever it might be. You know, that patience, we deny it, we repress it. And that creates a level of internal tension. Right? In fact, there's a little bit of internal violence to that, that we're denying a part of ourselves. So if all these distortions, if we start to tune into it, we can start to pick up on how they show up. This whole list of the paramis doesn't have things like mindfulness, doesn't have investigation, doesn't have concentration. Doesn't talk about wise view or wise intention other than through the wisdom aspect of that. So that's why we need to bring these other parts of our practice to bear upon that. To learn, okay, how am I showing up in this? A really important way to integrate our life and our practice is to be internally sensitive to contractions of heart, contractions of the body, the way that those contractions and also the belief system distort the way we perceive the world. We perceive the world based on those distortions. We see criticism when there's not really criticism. We see judgment when there's not. Right? And so it's easy to slip into that. And they're so convincing. It's so feels so real because it's really our mind is creating the world that we're living in. So the saving grace of this is that mindfulness practice comes back to just connecting with what actually is. As we try to start the meditation, it's just that simple acknowledgement. How is this body right now? How is this mind? How is this heart? Not what we think it should be or we want it to be, but how it actually is. And as we practice the paramis, you know, in this perspective, that helps us to safeguard against some of these distortions. You know, that willingness to, okay, what's actually here? What's actually present? And then we can bring a lot of energy around each of these paramis. How do I really work with some of these? How do I develop them? How do I see where I struggle with them? How do I nurture them? How do I cultivate them? So looking at these paramis, just really touching upon each one, and then we'll have a chance for you to put your own voice out, your own experience around working with the paramis, and any distortions that might come up. So generosity, the first parami. This one, you know, part of this is what comes up is that conditioning or our family programming or cultural programming that this is how I should be. I should be generous. You know, I should be this way, right? And if we're not feeling generous, if we're feeling a contraction of heart, right there, we're into that opposition. If we're trying to force ourselves to be generous without really acknowledging that, then there's distortion that comes up. The other way to look at it is like, oh, the heart is contracted. The heart, I'm not feeling generous at all right now, and yet I want to cultivate that. So let me get to understand what that contraction of heart feels like. How can I play with generosity in small ways that feel doable, that feel I can do this. This starts to transform it in a very gentle way. Ethics, you know, ethical conduct or morality or virtue. It's a foundation of our practice, and yet we can start to become very sometimes a little tight around that. Remember, the precepts are phrased as to undertake the training to refrain from. Okay, undertaking the training to refrain from. So there's an understanding in that verbiage or that way it's articulated that sometimes it's hard to fully follow all these precepts. Let's take the first one, refrain from taking life, from killing. How many people brush their teeth today? You know, what happened to those little poor bacteria in your mouth? How many people have taken antibiotics? You know, those poor bacteria, you're killing them. So that's you know, it's kind of an extreme thing, but we can take it that extreme. You know, sometimes we struggle with what to do with pests, what to do with termites. And I work with it just as, how can I be conscious around it? Is there any alternative other than taking this creature's life? Is there a way to not harm? And sometimes it's like there's this mutual incompatibility that comes up. Also, we can look at ethics in terms of kind of, there can be the external expression of the ethics, and sometimes that's a superficial expression. And I think this calls us into going into a much more deeper relationship to ethics, especially if you're in a profession or a role in your life that you have more power. Let society grants you more power, more authority, to be aware of that it's easier to cause harm without even meaning that you are. And to realize that there's the power dynamics, the marginalized people in our world, being extra careful of how our actions show up. Renunciation. And renunciation is one of those ones that I think it's easy to kind of get tied in knots around. Because we hear tales, we hear stories, and we feel like, okay, I need to renounce all these things. How many of us have come back from a retreat and we want to just give up all our worldly possessions or give up all our, you know, I'm never going to watch TV again. I'm never going to do this again. And yet it starts to come back in. And that's kind of this idealism that kind of starts to come forth. I think renunciation is really ideally done with a lot of support. The support of the people around us, their support of our foundations of our lives, the conditions of our lives. But most importantly, they're the support of our wisdom. Excuse me. Our wisdom of knowing what really causes suffering and what leads more toward freedom. That's a very, very different thing to renounce from, have a renunciation of something that we know, we see directly for ourselves, this is causing harm, suffering in myself and others, versus I should renounce that, right? You feel it's a pretty simple difference, but yet we can become really caught in that. Basically taking the idea of what we should be versus the interior relationship to it. Energy. You know, energy is one of those ones that we need a lot of energy to practice, because it's been said that Dharma is going against the stream of our lives, going against the stream of society and culture. You know, learning how to go against that, you know, the consumer model, for example, or that sense of inadequacy that drives so much of our actions and behaviors, the sense of being distracted, you know, seeking pleasures, that just we just get lost in that. It's going against that stream. So the energy is needed to be able to practice, to start to have a foothold. Energy can show up just as coming here tonight, to be willing to practice, whether you're here in the room or at home, that willingness to set aside the time to devote yourself to practice. Sometimes the energy becomes a little misdirected. We think we know where we want to go, and we put a lot of energy to it, but there's kind of inherent distortion with that. You know, that my own life, my own practice, trying to work really hard at relaxing, you know, and finding hard, you know, ways to make it a really difficult thing. How can I force my body to relax? How can I force my heart to open? You know, that's the strategy that brings a lot of energy. Energy is fueling that strategy, but yet it's ultimately misguided. In some ways, that's kind of the, you know, the coyote teachings of our practice, or the way that when we fail or we find the futility of a way we're approaching, that's actually often can be a great learning. We learn through our struggles. We learn through, okay, I've tried this way and that way, and then the way it starts to open up that's actually beneficial. Now, patience, the next one. Patience is one of those ones that we often struggle with. Okay, how can I be patient? How can I open to this? But sometimes we find that patience becomes more of a passivity, that not wanting to act when we really should act, when we really should make a decision. You know, we spend so much time opening and being receptive to our experience, but sometimes we have to really act in a very direct, forceful, energetic way. You know, and that shows up in many different ways in our lives. So just to also notice, am I starting to make past that sense of being patient more of a stance versus when I do actually need to make a choice, make a decision? Truthfulness, the next parami. So truthfulness is about this expression of what, you know, what we perceive as being true in a very deep way. And ideally, our practice allows us to start to glimpse that truth more and more clearly. And sometimes that glimpsing or that seeing of the truth is by fault a little limited, a little bit skewed. And then our minds like to make a story around it, like to take a sense of ownership around it. This is the truth. Let me tell you the truth. Or even better, let me tell you why you don't see the truth. Right? I mean, how many religious wars are based on that? A very fundamental thing of what one side, one tradition thinks is true, the other one doesn't. And there's this conflict that comes up. And so you can start to tune into how much are you trying to defend what you think is true, you know, versus when you really know it's true, when there's a deep resonance, you don't have to really defend it. It's like someone's telling you it's really bright and sunny outside. You're like, okay, well, they're a little confused. They're a little deluded in this moment. But you know for yourself, your own senses are so clear. It's the same thing with all the Buddhist teachings, all the paramis, all the different teachings we can point to. They're all glimpses or expressions of the truth that we can take from an intellectual perspective, which can be helpful. But ultimately, it's our direct experience, our direct knowing, seeing it real time in our lives. That's where it starts to really come forth, when it really becomes an alive practice. And yet, when we do see that, we don't have to defend it. We don't have to proclaim it. You know, that's often maybe the self-image of being a truthful person, a wise person, that starts to come forth. Next parami is that of resolve. So resolve. So resolve, some of the distortions around it are when we get resolved or wrong thing, or maybe we're not very clear about the path, or our sense of the path, or the sense of who, what it means about ourselves isn't really grounded in reality, isn't really grounded in the truth, right? So for example, have you ever had this thought that I really want to be enlightened? All right, I'm going to do everything I can to be enlightened. All right, if that means I have to sit 8 hours a day, I'm going to sit 8 hours a day. I do these chants and this and that. But the idea is that what the distortion is, that there's a sense of you that's going to become enlightened. That there's going to still be you who's this kind of special version of yourself, special expression of yourself. Right, so that kind of a strategy sometimes can lead to a lot of striving, a lot of pushing through, a lot of spiritual bypassing. And eventually we realize that this whole thing of an awakening and enlightenment is actually about seeing through the nature of self, seeing through this idea of what I am, that limited view, that limited perspective, to a much broader, vaster expression than we can even self, since self cannot touch upon, cannot imagine. So that sense of resolve in its ideal state is this deep commitment, this unwavering commitment. And it's really direct, it has a very clear accuracy. It's like it's really going directly the right way. Like if we said we want to go directly north, if we had a compass that was off or there was a big magnet next to it, it would change where that north arrow went, or we didn't even have the compass. But if we have a clear compass, then we can align everything along that. So loving kindness, the second to last parami. So loving kindness, this is where some of that, when a common expression is, or distortion, I should say, is when we are trying to be loving even when we don't really feel loving inside. You know, we express that sense of kindness or sweetness or gentleness, where inside we're just like writhing in anger and resentment, and we're just really pissed off, and we're just kind of repressing that because we want to put forth this image of being a loving person, a kind person, right? So that distancing from what we really are feeling and what we think we should be, that's going to eventually fail. It's eventually going to fall apart. Is that story of the maid kind of provoking the mistress into really losing it and getting really angry and even violent, you know, and seeing that, okay, that's the conditions are such. So this is where our honesty of our practice and our investigation and our mindfulness comes forth. Okay, I want to cultivate loving kindness. How do I practice that? Where are there areas that I can't feel that quality of connection, that quality of turning toward? Investigate, turn toward those. What's that nature of that? What's the nature of mind that shows up in relationship to that contraction of heart? Not denying that the contraction is there, but actually using metta itself. Let me have metta toward that contraction. Let me be next to, let me turn toward that quality. And then finally, equanimity. Right? This equanimity is one of those big ones that, because that sounds so appealing to be equanimous, to have a sense of equanimity, to be unbothered by how life is coming and going, losses and gains. It's like, okay, I'm just really chill in all that. I have this sense of ballast that's affected. Right? That can be just a stance that we're trying to force ourselves into. Right? We're trying, and you can just notice if you look internally, you can feel if there's that contraction, that denial, or the sense of distance or disconnection. Now, this is one that's a little seductive, so you might, if you have a friend or a loved one or a spouse or a partner, you might just have, you know, check out with them who's someone who's honest with you. You know, how do you think I am with this equanimity? And they might tell you, well, you seem like you're kind of cool and aloof. You seem like you're kind of removed and distant, right? And that should be a good reality check to listen to that feedback and say, okay, maybe I'm misinterpreting this. Because equanimity, like all these paramis, comes from this cultivation and culmination of wisdom. You know, something lets go in us, and what arises is equanimity. So these are just some distortions that I've learned in my own practice and seen with working with students. And I think it's one of those things we should bring forth and anytime we work with the Dharma, when you feel like, okay, I want to get this place, I want to get this teaching. Bring your self-awareness along with that. How are you relating to it? How are you adapting to it? Because the Dharma, it ultimately is about this sense of inner freedom, this becoming more and more who and what you really are. All right. So thanks for listening. Let's just take a couple moments to sit quietly, letting those words settle. All right. Welcome back. Hi, Eva's cat. All right, so this group here is a nice chance to be. It's kind of a, you know, smaller group at the holidays, and it's a chance to really, you know, how honest can I be? Can I bring forth, you know, notice if I want to present myself as being this spiritual person that never has any issues with any of these things. You know, maybe there's more growth or more learning by willingness to be vulnerable, to share a little bit, and to hold the groups with confidentiality, tenderness, you know, care that, you know, people might be willing to share in a deep way, and to hold that. And you know, you share whatever, you know, level feels comfortable for you. But these paramis, you know, I think each one of us, we can look at them: generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. You've got to have some distortions around at least one of them. All right. So talk about that. Talk about it in an honest way and how you maybe struggle with it. Maybe you don't have no idea how to work with it, or maybe how you worked with it and you've grown from that, and just see what arises. So we'll take 20 minutes for this. We'll have groups to 4 to 5. And those online, if you're choosing not to participate in the dyads, but you want to continue being in the group, if you could just pop off the meeting and come back in 20 minutes, we'll let you back in. That way it's easier for us to set up the Zoom breakouts. So the topic is just around these 10 paramis. You know, you can talk about one or several. And how do you kind of create your own distortions? What have you noticed around yourself, around this, your own practice? Right? Okay, welcome back. So we have some space for any sharing or questions you might have around what you explored or things you like to dialogue around. So in the room, you can raise your hand, and it looks like Adam will bring the mic around, and online you can raise your virtual hand and we can call on you. Okay, go ahead, Ricardo.
Hi, nice to meet you. It's Ricardo. Nice to meet all you guys. I was wondering, for me personally, it's really difficult with, dealing with external environmental factors like, my pets are super loud in the house. So, I don't know if you have any thoughts on how to, cancel out almost all the sounds in your house. Or, what to do in that situation, like, get a crate or, build out a meditation zone or, how do you create that peace for yourself, in your house if you have dogs or, I also sometimes have, my nephew will come over and he's very loud, kind of, rummaging around, maybe eating Oreos or something. So, how do you guys find that peace to meditate?
Sure, yeah, that external distractions and noise. So if we're kind of newer to practice, it often can really throw us off our game. It can make us really, it can be hard to find that foothold in practice. So one way to work with that or play with that is to start to make the sound just another thing in the background. So you can say, okay, there's the crunching of the Oreos or there's the dog barking or whatever it might be. Because we often think in the West here that meditation should be completely silent, the environment should be particularly quiet. You go to Asia, often it's not that case. Sometimes the meditation centers, like some of the Mahasi centers, apparently right in the city. So there's construction, there's loudspeakers, all this stuff going on around you. And one question is, okay, is the sound bothering you, or are you bothering the sound? Right? So that's kind of a way to practice and grow with that. That being said, trying to find a more idealized way of practicing so there's less distractions can be helpful as we start to get our kind of our roots or our foundation around it. Sometimes just putting earplugs in could work, or noise canceling earphones, or maybe finding a place outside your home, maybe going out to a park or someplace. I love to just sit and meditate out in nature and just hear the birds, hear the traffic, hear the people around me, and it becomes another thing that I'm practicing with. Because sometimes our lives are like that. We have young children, we have animals, we have busy house partners or mates and whatnot, and learning how to, okay, how can I still practice in the midst of that? All right, what else is out there? Any other questions here in the room? All right, go ahead, Gustavo.
No, sorry, I was a little late to the classes, but I didn't get a chance to discuss in the small groups, guys. I didn't get to discuss with like or something, but I did want to say that I am struggling kind of similar to a couple of people. I think kind of relaxation, noise, and putting low frequencies like set like 100 hertz, to meditate, and also some like essential oils and like scents, and I kind of get off the couch most of the time. I feel myself kind of dozing off and not really paying attention to the meditation, as you know. So I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
So you were breaking up a little bit, Gustavo. I didn't quite catch everything about that, your question. Could you say it again? Dozing off during meditation? Okay, dozing off. Yeah, so dozing off, thank you. So if you feel like that
So
sensitive,
sorry.
yeah, go.
I was dozing off, and it was that I just had a hard time kind of getting to my relaxed state.
Yeah, I'm missing a lot of the nuances, but I can talk about sleepiness
Yeah.
and yeah, doziness around practice. So sometimes it has to do with just our life circumstances that we're not getting enough sleep, we're really stressed, and we have to kind of learn to kind of recalibrate how can we be present while our eyes are closed, where we're not doing much. Because usually eyes closed, we're not doing much, it's time for nap, right? It's time for going to sleep. So sometimes it's working with the conditions of your life, trying to get a little bit more sleep. Sometimes it's finding the right time of day that maybe you're more energetic, if that's possible. Sometimes you have the flexibility to kind of fit that in. Sometimes you don't. Maybe first thing in the morning, or maybe in lunchtime, or when you come home, a little bit more energy. Posture can be really helpful. If you're sitting on the couch, that's the body's going to be much more relaxed and kind of sinking into the couch. So you might try sitting more upright, even having your back, if you back and support that, free of the back of the chair. So there's a sense of uprightness there. Opening your eyes can be helpful. Standing up, maybe doing walking meditation instead of sitting meditation if it's really drowsy. But it's one of the five hindrances. It's a very common thing that we work with and learn how to practice with. All right, let me go back to the room. Anyone have any questions or sharing here? Okay, Adam, go ahead.
Since I've already got the mic. I was listening to you talk about resolve, and I have some questions about that, because I feel like the way you were pointing to resolve, kind of, I was thinking of it through the lens of, it's kind of like the resolve to allow yourself to connect deeper and deeper to the Dharma.
Yeah.
And to move forward in that way. And it feels like that's a really wonderful expression for somebody who has really steady mindfulness throughout the day and really steady connection to truthfulness and really steady energy mm-hmm. to practice in that way. And that doesn't feel like where I'm at. And so I'd love to some ideas of how can you practice with resolve when you have these, you know, diurnal patterns of energy and mindfulness, and you slip into, you know, kind of deeply embedded patterns and come out and realize that you haven't been very, you know, mindful. And, you know, when resolve really sounds like something that opens up kind of, from the way you were describing it, as you're really deep into the practice.
Yeah, so resolve in the midst of life that, rising and falling energy, getting forgetful, reactive, all those patterns, where does resolve come in? So finding a resolve that you can actually be successful at maybe is the first step. To kind of maybe recalibrate what your goal is, because resolve often has a goal with it, right? Like, my goal is to be 100% mindful 100% of the time and not let one word slip that's unkind and unmindful, right? So that's good luck with that one. That's not going to work so well. But if you can start to switch that, okay, I'm going to, and it's trying to find something that's really transferable that you can kind of track and also kind of catches your attention. So, from what I know about you is that you're a caring kind of person, right? So maybe notice every time that your heart feels contracted, and then okay, how can I practice with that? Practicing with it is different than judging yourself for how you fell down, how you said something unkind or harshly or got reactive or lost your cool. That's kind of using Dharma as a weapon against yourself. But when you notice, oh, the heart's contracted, use that. It's almost like a bell that's ringing. You can, like, you hear that bell, you feel that contraction, and then, okay, that's the resolve, is to meet that as fully as you can. And if you don't have the time to meet it right then, okay, I'll come back and meet it when I can. I'll sit with it. I'll open to it. I try to feel whatever was there and try to learn from that. So that's a different kind of a different way of working with it. Instead of trying to be mindful and being frustrated because you're not present, that you're forgetting, but actually use it as a chance to really learn about yourself. And also, part of that resolve too is being realistic about your life situation, the demands upon yourself. Excuse me. The struggles that you're facing, and being compassionate for yourself. Bring maybe part of that feeling, that contraction, as soon as I feel it, I want to bring compassion to the fact that my heart is closed here, or tight to, or hurt, or angry, or frustrated. So you lead with that quality of compassion. So that resolve is very different, right, than trying to be perfect a perfect parami practitioner, but instead to be attentive, pay attention to what really is helpful. Because we can't be paying attention to everything. You know, even if we're going on retreat, those of you who are on retreat, you know, you can really slow down and really start to notice, but there's still lots of things you're not able to track. And there's still times you lose your focus. But you start to learn to focus on what's most important. And suffering, you know, is another way of saying it. Noticing when that is, that can be a very helpful one to pay attention to.
Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. All right, let's focus on people who are in the groups in terms of questions and sharing. Anyone else like to ask or share anything who is in one of the discussion groups? Yeah, go ahead.
One thing that came up in our group was truthfulness at work. You know, truthfulness, how to be truthful when we can see a problem and we're being misused, really. And how do we take care of ourselves and how do we be truthful when it comes back that we're just complainers or this or that? Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, so you know, it's like in a work situation, of course, there's all the dynamics and relationships and, you know, all different realities and how that, so you have to kind of, you know, navigate all of that. But I think it's helpful to, you know, as best you can, just kind of voice it, you know, clearly as you can, like, okay, I'm feeling this sense of, you know, being misused or being unacknowledged or criticized or whatever it might be. And try to start with your own kind of ownership of your experience. Now, what that looks like is going to change based on the situation. Like some corporate settings, that's going to look really different than maybe in something that's more, you know, emotionally friendly, for example. And so try to share that, to talk about that, and then, you know, also listen to the other point of view. Because there's often, you know, we as human beings, we just see one part of ourselves, and sometimes we don't realize, oh, maybe our actions are, you know, are causing harm or we're being harmed, and just trying to make that kind of a dialogue. So that's kind of a just if the situation is such. Another way is to try to establish that as a you know, kind of an agreement of how we work together. You know, like maybe we have an agreement that we're able to voice this or talk about it or find someone that you can kind of mediate with, you know, like, okay, you know, I'm having trouble with this one person or this one situation and seeing if someone can help you with that.
It's a tricky situation.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I've had experiences myself and, you know, all of us who have had jobs,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's safe to speak up and oftentimes it's not.
Yeah, that's the rub. That's where the discernment comes in. And sometimes if it's really not safe to speak up and it feels like things are just it's not going to get any better, then maybe it's time to find a different position or a different supervisor, or different work and make those kind of changes. And that's that fine line. It's like, how can I try to change things, but if I realize, okay, this is just the system's not going to allow that change, then maybe it's better for me to be with the thing that changes. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, because there's so many things are not healthy for us to be in, unfortunately, in this world. Yeah. All right. We'll come to Lori in just a second here. Go ahead.
I just want to paraphrase or say back to you what I think you said, but I
okay.
So was the first step just like be clear to yourself about the situation, and then the second step is then talking to someone else if that makes sense. Is that what you're saying or no?
You know, I didn't actually say that so clearly, but I like that paraphrasing. I think that's a good first step, is because in any situation when we feel like we're really struggling with something, it's sometimes hard to tell how much of that is my conditioning that I'm kind of, you know, kind of butting up against life, and how much of it is the outside, you know, what's internal, what's external. And usually it's some kind of mixture, right? But trying to get clear with ourselves And ideally, you find, you know, someone that you can be a sounding board who's outside of that situation, I think is really a beautiful way. Or you can, maybe you can write about it and kind of let you give yourself permission to really vent and say things you wouldn't say in person, to kind of let everything be aired out and see. And often by doing that, then the clarity starts to come, like, okay, yeah, that part seems a little archaic, or that feels like, you know, mom stuff or dad stuff or brother or sister or sibling, all those kind of things. Okay, so that's getting triggered. This other part just seems like they're not treating me in a fair way, you know, and then you start to clarify around that. Yeah, so it's messy. But it's like the more clear you can be with yourself, the more you can be kind of a refuge for yourself to really know your own experience. I think that's really a fundamental thing. And then you decide, what actions can I take? What communication can I bring forth? You're welcome. Okay, Lori, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I am struggling with loving kindness. There you are. Just with difficult people, and I had the similar situation at work. If I speak up being truthful, oh, you're just a problem child, you know, you like to make trouble. But I'm trying to see this situation where I was really hurt and betrayed by a family member, and I'm trying to extend love and kindness to that person, and more for me and less for them. I don't really mean it. It's not my heart. So then I have the problem of, well, it's not true. I'm faking it. I just like to have some hints or how you open your heart and mean it more. Because then if I don't feel it, I feel like I don't even want to say it, you know. So I don't believe it. So how do you get there?
How do you get there from where you are? And you're talking particularly about self-compassion for yourself?
No, for another person that I feel hurt me deeply.
Yeah, and a family member, someone that you have a long history with. Yeah, so it's a similar process that you might even just kind of let that other person kind of put them put the action or communication around them aside for a while, you know, till you have a kind of an inner clarity or inner kind of quality of compassion for yourself first. I think that's very helpful. Like for myself, you know, from kind of therapy training that I had, we talked about being hooked, right? When you're really hooked by someone. And that hook means there's a kind of a reactivity, there's a pattern, and you get into a lot of unclarity, you get into your script, to use another therapy term. So all that stuff kind of triggers around. And it's going to be hard to, unless a person really has a lot of capacity to really meet you and open to you, it's likely to just kind of reinforce it. You know, there's all that going on. So it can be, like we were talking about just a second ago, some situations we step into, you know, we get more hurt the more we engage with them. But working with yourself for a while, it's like, okay, I'm going to not worry about acting with that person if I can, but my own self, really getting to know, okay, where's that contraction and feeling? Okay, let's just start with the body. I love to start with the body. Okay, I feel that hurt. I feel a tightness in the center of my chest. And as I follow the movement, like my whole body wants to move around. That just tends to be how I like to look at it, like kind of a somatic quality, letting it be felt a little bit more fully, a little bit more expressive. Because a lot of times those pain patterns, they kind of, by nature, we kind of contract around. We don't open them too very fully. But letting them be aired out a little bit, that allows us to start to see the deeper beliefs that arise from that. In the way, maybe there's the pain underneath the pain. Like, let's say, you know, if maybe the sense of hurtness Sometimes that leads more with anger. Sometimes there's more sadness. Sometimes there's more fear. But maybe noticing what's the initial emotion, completely try to allow it the best you can. So sometimes it's writing it. Sometimes it's going out in nature and expressing it, you know, talking to a therapist, all these qualities, until you start to feel, oh, there's a deeper quality of emotionality underneath that. And there's a deeper belief I didn't even realize. Once I start to see that, then for me, it's like when I talk to that person, there's kind of a recalibration that's happened. What I mean by recalibration is I'm not trying to solve my past through this person. I'm not trying to solve those unmet needs or those wounding or that trauma through this person. I'm clear about that. I'm clear that, that's a hurt there, that's in myself. And then I come with a different level of clarity around it. And then once you have that clarity, then see if there's a way to dialogue, a way to open to this person in a different way. You know, try to see their point of view or listen to them. But it's be very patient, I think, if you can with this. We have the holidays coming up, so maybe there's going to be like, okay, I'm going to be with that person. What do I do with them? Maybe it's a chance to give you your more space around that person. Okay, I start to get triggered. I'm going to go take a walk or go help in the kitchen or whatever it might be. Does that help at all, Lori?
Yeah. And I have found out that I need the compassion for myself too, because I was been real hard on myself in the past. So yeah, that does help.
Yes. Yeah. I think that being hard on yourself, that's probably the key is working with yourself, working with your own, you know, the own hurt you carry toward yourself. And as you open to that, and this, you know, I can just say in a couple words, but it's, as we know, those of us who've done that work, it's a process, you know, and it's something that we deepen into. So be kind to yourself, be gentle with yourself.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, go ahead, Romali.
Can you please repeat what you just said, the pain you carry, hurt you carry for yourself?
The pain, which part again? Say it again.
Did you say?
Didn't realize. Did you say the pain you carry towards yourself about like a past relationship that really can't, okay, let me start again. Is it just acknowledgement about the past relationship that cannot really be resolved by that person, that pain needs to be resolved within myself? Is that right?
I wouldn't say as an absolute. I'm just saying that sometimes it's hard to, sometimes the situation, it's hard to really have a real conversation with that person because of their own wounding or their own ignorance, their own reactivity, the amount of harm they caused you, and you just get so charged by it. It's sometimes it's hard to work with that person initially. But working with yourself, I mean, that's, you get to be with yourself till you're no longer here. So might as well get really used to working with yourself and deepening around that and turning to your own internal pain and learning to navigate that. Now, it's to the point where it starts to shift. It starts to, I think that's the big piece is, there's an initialness around it, initial expression of it. If we work with it in a careful way, in a way that's helpful, there's often a shift underneath to something else. If we see it in a more full way, right, and that helps us understand ourselves in a more deeper way. And then from there, then maybe there's a way, something loosens then in the dynamic. And there's so many different ways we could talk about it. Like if my two fingers were meeting like this, this is my relationship with the person, and this is how I fit in with them, I'm going to just keep going back into that. But if I shift and this becomes something completely different, it doesn't quite fit. But maybe they can shift because you've shifted. Or maybe they say, no, go back to this. And it's like, oh, I don't really want to do that. And then we see what happens. Yeah, it's this being human is it's tough sometimes, isn't it? All right. Well, so with that, I want to thank everyone for your questions and your sincerity. So, you know, if you celebrate the holidays, may that be as kind, as warm, as gentle as you can. And if you don't celebrate it, or you know, enjoy the stillness of this time of year. You know, find that the mystery of that. And next week we'll have a final talk for this year. And I think I'm going to do something. We have, I don't know if you saw these great cards that you know Cheryl and Tori made up. And it's the next year is the Four Noble Truths. So I'll probably talk about something about connecting the paramis with the Four Noble Truths. I think that's where I'm leaning toward. All right, so may you be well, and we'll see you next week or next year or whatever that might be. All right, thank you all.